the world's up until just the last few years thought that Tesla was crazy and that Tony was crazy. And well, who's laughing now, right? I mean, it's the proof is in the pudding.
One question that can sometimes keep me up at night, and one that is very important for the world, is can technology, and better yet, new clean technologies, can they disrupt energy, transportation, food, and labor? Will we be able to solve our most important challenges, including climate change? Today, we will meet Adam Doerr. Adam is the director of research at RethinkX, an independent think tank founded by Tony Seba and James Erbib. Over the last 5 years, they've published landmark research about the disruption of energy, transportation, and food by new technologies. Adam has also just published a new book, Brighter: Optimism, Progress, and the Future of Environmentalism, with a video series to come. What Adam is excited to share with you is that he and his colleagues at RethinkX are now able to show the data that there's never been greater cause for optimism. Thank you so much for joining me, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. And you nailed it with that introduction. It sounds pretty amazing when you lay it out so eloquently. But yeah, that's the idea. My team is trying to show that when you understand the dynamics that drive technology and disruption, and you see from the data where the trends are headed in solar, wind, and batteries and energy technologies, for electric vehicles and batteries and autonomous driving in the transportation sector, for precision fermentation and cellular agriculture, the two key technologies in the food sector, and then artificial intelligence and robotics in automation in the labor sector. When you see all of those come together and you see where the curves are headed, the exponential trajectory that we're on, it's enormously exciting. And it's a thrill to see that all of this is pointing us to a brighter future, not to the dismal, austere, darker future that so many of us, I think, have come to believe when we read the headlines in the news. And so, as you can imagine, I'm very passionate about spreading understanding about those data and sharing the optimism that I've come to see. And I'm in the same situation you described. I was a doomer. I was a degrowther. That was my training as an environmental scientist 15 years ago. And I've completely shifted my view based on understanding what the data in the technology domain tell us. So it's pretty exciting stuff, I have to say.
Absolutely. I am all on board this. I'm an optimist myself. I love that you and I both named your book Brighter. This is Brighter with Herbert. It's all about learning information, but also being optimism. And we'll ask that question about, how can you be an optimist in today's world where pessimism and being able to, curtail the limited resources, but I think you've got a better answer than that. The first question I want to ask you, though, is on your website, you have this wonderful sentence that I absolutely love, and it's like, we are on the cusp of the fastest, deepest, most consequential transformation of human civilization in history. Tell me more about disruption and the convergence of technology. This is what's exciting for all of us. Is technology going to solve all of our problems?
Well, it certainly gives us tools that we can use to build prosperity if we choose to. Now, of course, it's always a choice. Every tool can be used for good or it can be used for ill. Mm. But we are going to have options. We are going to have possibilities that defy the normal imagination, the normal story that we've been told. And this is because we're on track to see exponential growth, the stereotypical pattern of disruption we've seen throughout history, the S curve, which is right on the cover of my book. It's why it's on there. We have seen that disruptions always follow the same pattern. They follow an S curve. They explode exponentially in their early growth stage before then slowing down as they reach saturation. But that pattern we've seen again and again throughout history. We've going back as far as Neolithic arrowheads, thousands of years ago. For technologies as different as carpenter's nails are from digital cameras, the pattern and the dynamics driving it are the same. And one of the things that's so unintuitive is how quickly disruptions happen. They happen in just 15 to 20 years, typically. And the reason why is because they're driven by economic forces. So in the case of these new technologies that are poised to disrupt, as you mentioned, energy, transportation, food, and labor, the disruptions are poised to happen because better, more competitive, better money for value is on offer from solar and wind and batteries than is achievable with fossil fuels, for example, in the energy space. It's not because we want to change because these are clean technologies. That's an extra benefit. But disruption is about the economics. We, for example, we've had dirty disruptions in the past. They're not always clean. Fossil fuels themselves were a disruptive technology in the 19th century, and they disrupted biofuels, the 19th century biofuels of the day. So disruptions aren't always clean. What drives them is the fact that you can obtain more value for less money. And that is, as we know, one of the most powerful incentives in the human world is that economizing. Well, we stand at this extraordinary moment because we're witnessing a convergence of multiple technologies across all four of these sectors: energy, transportation, food, and labor, and the technologies that I mentioned. And the icing on the cake is that they're all clean. It didn't have to be that way. It's just an astonishing stroke of good fortune that it's clean technologies that are going to be cheaper. It's clean transportation, electric vehicles that are going to outperform and outcompete on cost and other metrics, ICE vehicles. It's just good fortune. So this is pretty extraordinary. Now, I like to point to a recent disruption we've all lived through. I shouldn't say all, because I'm now getting old and there are young people who are really probably quite young in the days before the internet existed. But for people certainly in their 40s or older, you'll be able to remember a time before the internet. And the world before the internet was completely different than the world after the internet. So in 1992, 93, we have the advent of the World Wide Web, the world's first web browser. Mosaic appears as the first websites. And it was only 15 years from that point until the launch of the first iPhone, just so quickly. And we can all, those of us of a certain age, remember how it seemed like it would be decades before anybody was crazy enough to buy something over the internet. Who would buy anything? Who would buy, you know, who would order dinner on the internet? Who would buy a book on the internet, let alone who would buy a car over the internet? Who would go on a website and buy a car? Who would trade stocks in their stock portfolio, their life savings, through a computer? This just seemed insane to many of us in 1992. But it was just 15 years later when people were doing all of that through their phone, right? So disruptions happen extremely quickly. And so we're now at the point where we can see we're at the takeoff point in all four of those domains: energy, transportation, food, and labor, all four of them. Now, any one of them alone, any one of them would just be transformational for society because they are foundational sectors. They are what our world, the human world, what our economy and our civilization is built on, those things, along with a handful of other foundational sectors like information, which the internet just disrupted over the last 30 years. So it's not we're just going to have one of these. We're going to have four of them simultaneously, all accelerating and feeding into one another. This is virtually to my knowledge, looking at the history of disruption, this is unprecedented. We stand at an unprecedented moment. We've never seen this much change in the offing all at once. And as I said, it's an extraordinary stroke of good fortune that, as far as we can tell, all of those disruptions have the potential to be clean disruptions. And they didn't have to be because we've had dirty ones before. So yeah, the possibilities are just going to explode in front of us. And that's why I'm so excited. We're going to have completely new tools in our hands.
Hey there, thank you for joining me. If you can, please consider supporting this channel so I can keep it going. It's a lot of work arranging all these amazing interviews. One of the easiest ways is just to click that join button and become a member of the channel. Thank you very much. Let's get brighter. It's at the cusp of the exponential curve going up, skyrocketing straight vertical up. Why do people not recognize that it's about to come? Why do they not even when they see it changing quickly, they still do a linear line when they look forward. And then, you know, bring it back to Tesla a little bit. How did Elon and Tesla know that this was the right timing? And it seems to be the right timing and things have happened. Did they force it to happen or were they just there at the right place, right time? What do you think happened to Tesla and their role in helping, you know, move us to the energy abundance future?
Well, I think it's very clear that Tesla has acted as an accelerant on the disruption of transportation and subsequently on the disruption of energy. And now, looking forward, the disruption of automation and labor as well. So Tesla's been instrumental in this. I don't think anybody could argue that we would be further along than we are without Tesla involved, without Tesla in the picture. I can't speak for the company or certainly for Elon. I haven't had a chance to talk to him personally about how early on in the Tesla story, this trajectory of disruption was clear. But one thing that seems completely self-evident to me is that Tesla understands disruption, and they understand how the two, transportation and energy, fit together and are intimately intertwined and connected. They've understood that for a long time, and they've understood that in a way that certainly none of their conventional competitors have understood, at least manifest in their actions and choices. Certainly individuals within any organization can have great understanding, but if that's not actionable, if that understanding isn't actionable, then we don't see evidence for it in the behavior of the institutions themselves. So with Tesla, what's been very clear in terms of their actions is that they've understood that electrification of transportation was inevitable, that it was ultimately going to be driven by economics, that it was going to be a massively disrupting forcing function, and thankfully that it was going to be an opportunity, a pathway to achieving a cleaner energy system for humanity, for our civilization. When they brought in energy as a part of the picture, then that just became even more clear that they shared the kind of understanding that Tony Seba had developed and was publishing starting in the late 2000s. Tony Seba is the co-founder of my organization, RethinkX, and he published Solar Trillions, one of his early books, in 2009, I believe. And that's trillion with a T. And people legitimately thought he had lost his mind. They just thought he was completely crazy. There's no way this can ever happen. This is, you know, if we ever do get to a clean energy future, it'll be 50 or 100 years from now. That's what the prevailing wisdom was at that time. And he published his second book, Clean Transportation, which told the story of how energy and transportation come together with solar power, electric vehicles, batteries, and so forth. And what we see is there's very close alignment between what Tony was doing and what he was analyzing and what his findings of his analyses and what he was publishing said, and what Tesla's actions have spoken, what the understanding that Tesla's actions have been speaking of, right? And again, the world's up until just the last few years, I think just thought that Tesla was crazy and that Tony was crazy, that this was ridiculous, what they were acting as if they believed about the future. And well, who's laughing now, right? I mean, it's the proof is in the pudding. And I think we're exactly where Tony predicted we would be. And I think we're very close to where Tesla and perhaps Elon Musk imagined we would be if you were to ask them 10 years ago. But 10 years ago, it was you were a long way out on a limb, pretty lonesome out on the far out on the limb, making those kinds of bold claims then. But this is what an understanding of technology and disruption gets you. It allows you to see much further ahead with much more clarity than you otherwise would be able to.
Yeah, I do have video of Elon being asked that question. You know, when does he think that we're going to get to 50, 60% electric vehicles? And we're getting there. 2026, I think, was the number he gave out there. So yeah, he might be off a few years, but you're right, right? When you go back even just a few years and you hear people say things like, you know, at some point, all cars will be electric vehicles, and people will think you're crazy, crazy. So one of the things you guys have said, and tell me if this is still true today, you have in one of your videos, you've said that we can reach 100% solar, wind, and battery by 2030. So that is what, 7 years from now, 100%. Right now, there is what, 10% of all cars being sold is electric vehicles, but there is, you know, we got nuclear, we have energy, we have peaker plants. How do we convert everything in there and then eventually get to solar and wind? I mean, I think we crossed the line now where solar and wind are cheaper today, eventually,
yeah,
at this point.
That's right.
Yeah.
We've definitely passed the point of the traditional point of cost parity, as it was traditionally conceived of. There are a number of different, there's some nuances there about exactly how you compare costs, whether or not you couple solar and wind with batteries for a complete 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year energy solution. And you, so there's some debate about what a true apples to apples comparison there is, but there's no question now that solar and wind are the cheapest forms of energy generation. That's unequivocal. Can we get there by 2030? The original analysis that we put forward was on a regional basis. And this was 3 or 4 years ago. So the original claim was regions that chose to lead could within a decade reach 100% clean electricity. They could be 100% solar, wind, and batteries for all of their electricity demand. And that is still possible in many regions, especially the regions that have been aggressive so far about adopting these technologies sooner rather than later. For the entire United States, 2030 is that's a pretty ambitious goal. I don't want to rule it out as totally impossible, but it probably would be more realistic to look into the mid-2030s for the U.S. as a whole and for the world as a whole. But ultimately, the message that we were trying to convey and that we've been trying to convey with our research from the start is that regions, communities, individual companies can choose. They can choose to embrace the technologies driving these disruptions. And those mm-hmm. that choose to lead can realize all of those benefits sooner rather than later. And it's not going to take 50 years. To realize those benefits, to get across the finish line. You can get there in 10 to 15 years because that's the nature of disruptions. And so it's definitely still feasible for the leaders to be there soon. But I think the bigger picture and the bigger challenge that we are called upon, I think, to answer is can we shift away from the conventional narratives that say this is something. These challenges, clean energy, clean transportation, that these are somehow challenges that are going to take our countries, our world, many decades out to the second half or even right. towards the end of this century to achieve. And we really wanted to blow up that whole myth and misconception. That is utterly false. And I think Tesla and Elon Musk are in a similar situation where they're often misunderstood on the specifics of the timelines, and for understandable reasons, people want to know quarter, when are you going to reach this milestone, and so forth, exactly. so on and so forth. But in the greater arc of history and the bigger picture, a few years either side isn't what really matters. What really matters mm-hmm. is that we're going to get there. We're going to have electric vehicles that outperform ICE vehicles in pretty much any way you can measure. We're going to have those within a few years, not 50 years from now. That was Tesla's sort of original message a decade ago, and they were right. You know, we're going to have cars that can drive themselves as safely or more safely than a human being under most or all conditions. And it's not going to be 50 years from now or 100 years from now. It's going to be 5 or 10 years from now or 2 or 3 years mm-hmm. from now. That those minutiae are not the important part of that story. The important part of that story mm-hmm. is the difference between a completely linear view of the future and an exponential understanding of the future.
So you're sticking with the 2030, 100% solar, wind.
In some regions, it's absolutely still possible.
Batteries. It's awesome. That's huge, huge, huge market.
The power of exponential growth gets you. That is what exponential growth gets you. You can imagine a linear line would be insane if you were to look at that. Our intuition is linear, and that is why these things seem so impossible. But exponential growth it changes the picture completely. And you would think we would understand that a little better by now after, you know, 50 years or more of Moore's law, but it's still unintuitive, profoundly unintuitive.
That's caveman brain. I keep asking that question. Exactly. That's the whole point. It's like, why do people still not get it? They still don't get it. Okay. So I want to show you, have you seen this? Obviously you have Tesla's Master Plan Part 3. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. When you saw this, is this something that you think will accelerate? Is it too ambitious? So this is one of their slides that they showed. What do you think about this?
We are in broad agreement with the big picture that Tesla presents here in this analysis. There are, you know, technical minutiae, methodological details that where, you know, we differ slightly in our take on things. But those, again, those, it would be easy to miss the forest for the trees if we fixated on the little details and differences where we disagree. We certainly agree on the big picture. I would say that the difference between what Tesla has presented in Master Plan 3 and what we show in our work is that I think Tesla is perhaps being deliberately conservative in the sense that they are presenting a lower boundary limit case. I think my interpretation when I read Master Plan 3 is they've made quite conservative assumptions throughout. The biggest one is that their assumptions about costs are basically at today's costs, XYZ would follow. But of course, costs aren't sitting still. They're stochastic changes. There's noise, there's ups and downs in the short term. But in the long run, the costs are all trending consistently over time. The trend is consistently downward. And so if anything, they are underestimating the feasibility. So I think what Tesla has done, and I think it's savvy, is they've laid out a very, very much bulletproof case by showing the most conservative, under the most conservative assumptions. Number one, it is possible to run civilization on clean energy. Number two, here is, broadly speaking, what it would look like to build the system that would meet those needs. And number three, we can do it with the material footprint and the material inputs and requirements without anything insurmountable, no insurmountable obstacles standing in the way. No key materials are in too short supply that would derail the entire transformation of the world's energy system. We have plenty of every mineral and metal that's required. There's more than enough space for all the solar panels and wind turbines, et cetera, et cetera. So as far as that goes, my team's findings have been very much in agreement. So the material we've published over the last 5 or 6 years has been very much in line with that general conclusion. I have to say it's very exciting, and it inspires confidence, I think, when multiple voices, and especially a voice as loud and prominent as Tesla, joins the chorus with what we've been shouting from the rooftops from Rethink X for many years now. That's great. Are there little bits and pieces? Are there little details where I don't quite agree with Tesla? Sure. I don't think hydrogen is going to be quite as prominent of a role as Tesla's master plan suggests, et cetera, et cetera. But the big picture, very, very much broad agreement. Yeah. And if anything, as I said, the future is brighter than what Master Plan 3 lays out. That is, if you can believe it, in my mind, from my perspective, that's the worst case scenario. The likely scenario is better than Master Plan 3. The likely scenario is it's cheaper. The likely scenario is we actually overbuild more solar and wind and have more superabundance of near zero marginal cost electricity. If anything, that's my view.
I love you. I like this. I like you. I like this optimism, but you do the research. That this is not just something
you're
just...
This is what the data say.
Right. One of the things my intro was that you actually have the data to be optimistic. Do you think that you were saying that not only Tesla will do this, will Tesla get into solar farms, like massive solar farms, or are they going to leave it to other corporations to do this? Sometimes when I bring this up, that I think that Tesla will do this, they have a three pillars for energy abundance, sustainable energy economy. One of them, the first one, is energy generation. And right now, Tesla's not doing that. But why wouldn't they do solar farms? And some people are saying, well, that's a commodity. There's other companies that will do that. What's your prediction of what's going to happen with solar generation or energy generation first?
Yeah, it's a, I mean, again, I hesitate to make any firm claims or assertions about the strategy of specific companies. Right. That's not the level of analysis that my team and our research normally focus on. It wouldn't surprise me in the least if a major player like Tesla chose to pivot in a direction that others would find unintuitive, if pivoting in that direction meant making larger investments in these disruptions, because they so clearly understand those disruptions. So I would not be surprised, but I certainly couldn't offer a concrete prediction about that. I think there's certainly a case to be made that the potential for return on investments in clean energy is so large that many, many companies in all over the world are going to be able to participate in this. And it's the same for electric vehicles and clean transportation. And Tesla and Elon Musk have been saying this for a very long time, that it's a direction that the entire industry and the entire sector is going to shift in. And there's more than enough room for many different players to be involved and to make huge moves and massive growth. But will Tesla build a certain type of power plant or offer a certain type of product or service itself? And on what timeline? Those things I can't speak to. But I guess I would say I would not rule anything out when it comes to Tesla. They've surprised us before. They can certainly surprise us again with huge, big moves, right? Wouldn't surprise me at all. But I don't know what their plans are.
Yeah. Tell me about energy superabundance. How soon can this be? What are the technologies that might be involved?
In our 2020 report on energy, we discovered two really very counterintuitive phenomena. They were thrilling discoveries scientifically. As a scientist, these were enormously exciting things to learn once we started modeling the system, changing fundamental assumptions that up until that point had seemed written in stone. It seemed crazy. One of those assumptions was you can build more solar and wind power capacity than is currently installed in conventional power generating capacity. You're not constrained. You throw out the assumption that you're going to replace every 1 gigawatt of coal power with 1 gigawatt of wind. That is once we realized that was a false assumption, everything became much clearer to us. What we realized is if you build substantially more, somewhere between, say, for example, 4 and 8 times as much generating capacity, then that drastically reduces the amount of battery energy storage that you need to have going along with that to have a completely reliable energy system. And that relationship, there's a trade-off there. You can either build lots of solar and wind with a smaller battery energy storage to go with it, or vice versa. You can cut much closer to the edge with your solar and wind, not build nearly so much, just a little bit more than the fossil fuels and other conventional sources we have installed now. But then you'd need enormous batteries. And that's what everybody thought up until 4 or 5 years ago. And we realized that it could be very different, that there was compelling logic for overbuilding solar and wind. And we identified an interesting nonlinear relationship in that trade-off. We call that the clean energy U curve. And there's an optimal point. There's the bottom of the curve is the lowest cost combination of solar and wind plus batteries together. It's not obvious. It's not intuitive. But once you realize that, you find that the cheapest system that you can build is one that has relatively small batteries and relatively large solar and wind generating capacity. And from that finding, from the finding that the most economic system, the lowest cost system, would have a surplus, a big, big surplus of electricity generating capacity. From that finding, it then followed that, well, wait a minute. For some portions of the year, you're going to have all these solar and wind turbines, solar panels and wind turbines, and they can generate electricity without fuel. They can generate electricity at very, very low, near zero marginal cost, because the cost of operations, the cost of maintenance, there's no cost of fuel. Those are all very, very, very low for solar and wind in particular. And once we realized it, we're like, this new energy system, the cheapest one that you could conceive of building, will naturally have this innate capacity to generate a super abundant supply of clean energy and energy that is at near zero marginal cost. Well, what do you call a future where the energy system is clean and super abundant at near zero marginal cost for most of the time? Well, we knocked around ideas and ended up saying, hey, that's superpower. That's what it is. And so we ended up calling that large surplus of clean near zero marginal cost electricity that's naturally produced by a 100% solar, wind, and battery system, we ended up calling it superpower. It's a fun play on words, but it captures the idea. It captures the sentiment, which is that we are going to have abundant, super abundant clean energy at very low cost in the future. And that is the result of the disruption running its course. That is naturally where we end up. When you just follow the numbers and you do the math, and you follow the logic, that is where we end up. We end up with a clean energy superabundance future. And as we know from all of human experience, anywhere that energy abundance goes, other forms of human prosperity follow. Mm-hmm. And so this abundant energy, especially if it's clean, if it doesn't have a terrible ecological or social downside to it, energy abundance opens the door to prosperity of all kinds. And so this is something that's hugely exciting and absolutely worth being optimistic about. It's one absolutely, of the ultimate enabling conditions for human prosperity.
Right. Civilizations, usually technology. But it's hard for people to wrap their heads around this, because we have lived through decades or centuries, and ever since the world was around, that there is not enough energy. We're fighting for scraps. It costs so much money. Don't waste that water. Don't waste that electricity. Wars are fought because of oil. And now you're telling me that there could be an abundant, a super abundant future of energy. It makes sense to me, because I can see that solar panels, solar energy is free. Elon calls it the nuclear fusion in the sky, and it's free. You don't need to create your own. And so there is a path. And like you said, not very few moving parts. If we capture it, and we're almost there, is what you're saying. So tell me about, like, first of all, the obstacles and you know, this concept. I think you guys talk a lot about it being optimistic versus just thinking about the constraints and why you need to change people's minds in that way.
Well, the prevailing thinking, at least to my view, certainly in my experience, is that we have inherited an intuition of scarcity. We've inherited a mindset of constraint and scarcity and limitations. And all of our institutions, our social and economic institutions, are built around, fundamentally, around scarcity. Economics itself is structured around scarcity. The allocation of scarce resources is one of the definitions of economics. And so shifting to abundance of anything is a monumental paradigm shift. And shifting to abundance in energy in particular is extraordinary. It's also extraordinary shifting to that in transportation. And it's going to be I don't have the words to describe how profound shifting to a superabundance of labor is going to be. Labor is the ultimate constraint. It is the most clearly scarce thing in our lives up until this point in all of human history, because labor is something that we have to do, and labor is hard. We define so much of our existence around this scarcity that labor imposes. Labor is ultimately the limiting factor on all of the value that we create as an economy or as a society. The toil the countless hours that humans have had to put into, with blood and sweat and tears, the creation of value, have deeply molded in our minds the importance, the ironclad laws and rules of scarcity. And so this is a deeply, deeply, deeply rooted frame of mind. And as I said, all of our formal institutions and many informal institutions are just organized around that fact of life, as it has been up until this point in human history. But technology is going to decouple us from those limitations. And the clean energy technologies that we just talked about are part of that picture. And then the another crucial part of that picture is going to be the machinery, the equipment, especially vehicles that are powered by the electricity from that clean energy. And then on top of that, the potential of those machines, those vehicles and other machines that are powered by clean energy, to operate autonomously with the aid of artificial intelligence technology. Put all of those things together and you have a superabundance of energy and transportation and labor. And that, I struggle to communicate how totally profound that transformation has the potential to be. Now, it could and likely will create tumultuous times for us in the near term. I mean, we're going to have to learn to adapt to this, and it's going to be quite a bumpy ride. And we can look in the rearview mirror and see that, you know, the internet was not just a smooth sailing every step of the way. There were a lot of bumps along the way there, and the internet transformed our lives because it totally changed communications. It totally changed our relationship to information. And it did very much the same thing. It made information, it shifted information from being something that was scarce, that only a few people could afford to have access to. It was very, very limited, that if every single unit of information had a high cost, had a high marginal cost. If you wanted to read the newspaper, you had to buy a copy of the newspaper. If you wanted to listen to a piece of music, you had to buy a recording of it, and so on and so forth. The internet and digital technologies and computation, computer technologies of various kinds, they together transformed information from a condition of scarcity to a condition of abundance, and we had to adapt to that. And the world that we live in today is very different in terms of information and communications than the world before the internet was. And we're now headed into that again. But this time it's not bits, it's electrons and atoms. And so this it's impossible to overstate how big of a deal this is.
Yeah, let's imagine a little bit. Okay, so first of all, I do need you to give me a time frame, because that's the other thing. Yes, I can see this happening. Don't know if it's going to be in my lifetime or not in 10 years. But what you're saying is that if everything we eat, we'll talk about food as well, products that we have, things that we use our money for, right? So there's a cost of building that product. And the cost of that building product is the manufacturing cost, human labor to create it. Then there's a cost of delivering that product. It's energy, right? You need to have oil and energy sources to create those factories and make those things work. And then you need the fuel cost to deliver. You need the human to drive it, boats, planes, bring the product to you. Then you need labor of just all these people moving around. If all three of those are abundant and, you know, minimal cost, then almost anything that I want, every price of everything should fall significantly. And then what happens when we are in a society where it's fairly, relatively not, you know, not inexpensive for me to get what I want? Are we going to be even greedier? Are we going to have like a house full of like a million things inside of it? I can't move. Like, I'm going to have 10 TVs. I mean, what's going to happen? But what's going to happen to work? What's going to happen to labor? So labor, we're talking about bots, right? So as not only the automation that's already happening now, but even more the humanoid robots, it's just going to completely change the world. Have you guys factored in the humanoid robot already now to, and tell me about the timeframes of when you think this, you know, this utopia, it sounds like, what might happen and when it will happen?
Well, I mean, again, I should emphasize that we still have to make good choices as individuals, as communities, as entire societies. That any technology is a tool, and tools can be used wisely or they can be used foolishly, right? We've known this since the invention of fire and so forth. So if we choose wisely, then a world of extraordinary prosperity lies as a possibility ahead of us, for sure. And we have to remember, I should back up just for a second and say, we should remember where we are today and how far we've come relative to our distant ancestors. I mean, we already, those of us fortunate enough to live in prosperous countries, in the wealthy countries of the world, and especially in the wealthy communities in the wealthy countries of the world, we live lives of prosperity and abundance and opportunity that our distant ancestors 1,000, 10,000, 50,000 years ago couldn't begin to imagine. We already live like gods compared to what the people of the past imagined might be possible and how they lived themselves, the scarcity and the trials and tribulations, the struggles that they lived with in their lives. So we've already achieved an extraordinary amount of prosperity, and we've adapted, and some of that we've taken for granted, and perhaps we should reflect better on that. Some of the prosperity has come with its own new sets of problems that our ancestors in the distant past couldn't have imagined of, but they're still troubled and we still have to deal with them. So as a quick example, eating too much is now as big of a problem in wealthy countries as not eating enough. That 10,000 years ago, that was an unimaginable problem to have, but it is a real problem. We've had to think very carefully about how to deal with that. So it is about making the best use of opportunities that present themselves. And we've already done an enormous amount of utilization of new technology throughout the course of human history. When we're fortunate enough to live in societies where good decisions have been institutionalized and put into place to create systems that are reliably beneficial and that minimize harm and social instability and so forth, many of us are fortunate enough to live in societies that are already very prosperous. So we've gotten a taste of this. But as the saying goes, you ain't seen nothing yet. The possibilities that are coming, because as technology drives us even further down the curve on the costs of everything, as you mentioned, that's going to blow up in the possibility space even further. So, right, as energy and transportation and food and labor all become cleaner and cheaper, so does everything else, because energy is an input into everything. Every good and every service has energy as an input into its supply chain or value chain somewhere. Basically, the same thing is true with transportation, maybe a little bit less so with food, but certainly with labor. Virtually every product and service you can name has labor as an input to it somewhere along the supply chain. Well, as all of those things get cleaner and cheaper, so does everything else. Everything else, all other goods and services get cleaner and cheaper. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we aren't going to have any problems along the way. Sometimes too much of something can create its own challenges and difficulties. But I think on balance, we're headed into a world where there are opportunities that from our vantage point now look pretty miraculous, truly marvelous. And okay. And the time frame is the last thing to mention here. This is 15 to 20 years away. It's not 50 or 100 or 1,000 years away.
Wow. Okay. I love your confidence there. So obviously, you know, I grew up in a very fearing climate change. And are you saying today that you've been communicating your research that climate change you feel is no longer, it's going to be solved, addressed? I know that Elon has been saying this recently. They're saying, you know, we don't need to be freaking out about it anymore. It's a lot of challenges, he says. We've still got ways to go, but that there's a path now for that to be resolved. Can I feel comfortable that that's the case? Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. And I think there is a bit of misunderstanding here, understandable misunderstanding. And unfortunately, I think my scientific colleagues in the environmental and climate science disciplines have have helped contribute to this misunderstanding amongst the public and policymakers. But there's a difference between recognizing that we are facing a serious problem. And I've argued in my own work, even before I was with Rethink X, I've argued in my work that climate change is actually a bigger problem than most of us realize. It's not a smaller problem than most of us realize. It is a gigantic problem, and it's actually worse than most people think. And I'll explain very quickly why that is with an analogy. The analogy I like to use is of a house on fire. So if you're standing on the street looking at your house and it's on fire, putting the flames out is job number one. You have to extinguish the fire, okay? And it's not enough to cut the flames back by 50% or 80% or 90% or 95%, right? So if in this analogy climate change, the flames are the greenhouse gas emissions. It's not enough to cut the emissions down 50% because half of a fire is still your house on fire. That's a gigantic problem. So job number one is get the flames extinguished to zero. That's all the way to net zero emissions following this analogy. But are you done when you're standing there staring at the smoldering ruins of your house when the fire department is packing up and leaving? No, you've done the easy part, put out the flames. The hard part is repairing all the damage to your house, fixing your house, restoring it, and then adding safeguards so that it can't catch on fire again in the future. So most of us, I think, and I think my scientific colleagues are at least partly to blame for this. Most of us among the general public are under the impression that we only need to either reduce greenhouse gases a bit, or at most, all we have to do is just get them to zero. And then the planet will naturally heal itself and recover very quickly on its own. And that is not true. And the scientific community has known that that's not true for several decades. We've known that even if we got to zero, we would then still have a long way to go in fixing the damage we've done already in the past to truly solve climate change. We have to heal the atmosphere and the oceans, by the way, in order to really solve climate change. So it's a bigger problem than people realize. So I'm not in a position where I'm denying the reality of climate change at all. I'm the opposite of that. I'm more pessimistic than most people because I think I have a more accurate understanding of the problem. But where my scientific colleagues differ from me in the environmental disciplines is they don't see a path to solutions, and they haven't up until now. And they've brought conventional assumptions, linear assumptions about the possible growth of clean energy, clean transportation, clean food, and so forth to the table, to their scenarios. And so when the climate science community has said, well, this is where we're headed over the rest of the century, unless we put the flames out right now, they're making a lot of assumptions about what's possible over the course of the century. And a lot of those assumptions are false because, unfortunately, many of my colleagues don't understand technology and disruption well enough to see the path that we really have available ahead of us. And I think that Elon Musk has a much clearer view of the technology, probably no surprise, that he's got a very clear of what's going to be possible with the technology that we're going to develop and deploy over the next decade or two. And once we develop and deploy that technology, then it will 100% become possible, not to just extinguish all of those flames, get all those greenhouse gas emissions to zero, but also to repair the damage that we've done in the past to the atmosphere and the oceans. And I talk a little bit more about that, obviously, as you can imagine, in my book and in our research work, but we can get there. Once we have those tools in hand, they will empower us to not only solve the first part of the problem, but the whole problem of climate change. Put out the flames and repair the burning building. We can do it all. And we can do it all not by, again, 2100 or, you know, 100 or 1,000 years or whatever from now. We can do all of this over the next several decades. And so if you're apprehensive under the cloud of gloom and doom about climate change, that is the best news that I can share, certainly, yeah, is that we will have the tools that are needed to solve this problem, even though it is a bigger problem than many of us imagine.
Very, very fascinating. so glad that you're explaining all this. It just obviously technology is something you guys have been studying, and you're studying the acceleration of technology. What about food? Tell me about food. How's that going to be solved? I've heard Elon say that there's no calorie deficit. There's a lot of food. It's being able to get that food to where the people need it. How do you see the future of food and how that's going to evolve?
Well, there are several new technologies, two chief ones, and then several that are variations on the theme in the food space today. Precision fermentation, which is the combination of precision biotech with the age-old technology of fermentation. Fermentation is how we make beer and cheese and wine and so forth. Put those two together and you have precision fermentation. This is where you can reprogram microbes like yeast to produce basically any molecule that you want, any protein, you know, lipids and so forth. So precision fermentation can make ingredients. And the other technology is what's now mostly being called cellular agriculture. This is growing animal cells and tissues in vitro, in laboratory conditions. Other names for it are lab-grown meat and so forth. Those two technologies together are disruptive in the same way that solar and wind and batteries are disruptive of energy. Precision fermentation and cellular agriculture are disruptive of animal food products, both land animals, all of the standard livestock that we produce for food on the land, and disruptive to all seafood animal products as well. So in the oceans, both of those. And the reason why is the same pattern that we've seen in all other disruptions throughout history, which is that these new technologies are on a trajectory of declining costs so that eventually they will equal and then vastly surpass in terms of affordability the what you can obtain from animals and the same level of quality or better quality. In many instances, precision fermentation and cellular agriculture will give us better quality food. I mean, after all, it's coming from controlled and in some cases laboratory environments. There's no blanketing fields with pesticides. There's no antibiotics. There's none of that stuff. There's no unimaginably horrible slaughterhouses involved. None of that sort of thing. If anything, we're likely to see higher quality, higher consistency, better safety, better reliability of these food products, and they're going to cost a fraction of the price for that same or better quality. That just those facts are clear to see, and they just spell disruption. Now, food is a little bit different because we sort of we have an instinctive apprehension about food. I mean, this is something we put in our body. There's something very primal about food. But come on, we have to be honest with ourselves. There are a lot of things in the grocery store that are pretty gnarly.
That's right.
Okay, in terms of how they're made and what the processing is and what conditions they come from, animal products especially. And we turn a blind eye to all of that. We don't worry too much about that, even the most picky of us. And then the other thing to remember is that the majority of the world's population can't afford to be all that picky, right? And so if there's an option that comes along and it's half or a quarter or a fifth or a tenth of the cost, the price, then that becomes a no-brainer decision. And so this is why a disruption of food by the numbers is also inevitable globally. And there are a lot of other benefits along with this, but the environmental ones are pretty clear. We use 25% of the habitable land surface of the planet to produce animals, whether to house and raise and graze them or to produce the feed, the crops that we grow to feed to them. 25% of all the land surface of the planet. We could get about 80% about that. About 4/5 of that would come back to us if we, by the end of the food disruption, if animal livestock were disrupted by these new food technologies. And that would free up an area of land, and this is truly breathtaking, it would free up an area of land the size of the United States, China, and Australia combined.
Wow.
Now that's a lot of land to repurpose to, well, whatever else you can imagine. I think key opportunities to shift that land use too are conservation, preservation, rewilding, reforestation. So my argument is that the disruption of food by these two new technologies is going to create a ecological restoration opportunity, whether it's rewilding or reforestation or whatever, at a scale that exceeds the wildest dreams of any conventional environmental activist or environmental scientist who hasn't studied and doesn't understand these disruptions and doesn't know that this is coming. This is going to be the best thing that has ever happened to ecological restoration opportunity on land, hands down. And ecologically, the end of the seafood industry in the oceans will be, well, the best thing that's ever happened to the oceans in human history. And so this is what is in the offing. This is what's on the table as a result of the food disruption. So this is, I mean, you know, there's a lot there to be excited and optimistic about. And then I don't know if we want to talk about it, but there are direct connections between the energy and the transportation disruption and the labor disruption right into food. Because of course, I mean, what are big inputs into the food industry after all? Mm-hmm. Energy, mm-hmm. transportation, mm-hmm. right? You've got to, mm-hmm. it takes a lot of energy to produce food. Well, both the traditional way, and it's going to take a huge amount of energy the new way. But very good news, we're going to have an awful lot of clean energy at very low cost, as we already talked about. So that's a direct input and accelerator of the food disruption itself. And then we're going to have the means to do the logistics, the distribution of all of that output from the new food system with clean transportation, mm-hmm. powered by clean energy. A lot of it's going to be automated. So all of these things dovetail and converge together to create this extraordinary, again, this unprecedented moment in history with all of these amazing opportunities.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so I was settling myself up for a dystopian future. Now you're helping me think of a utopian future. But so let me share a couple of my own predictions that I've been saying that many people don't agree with me. So number one, I've mentioned that I think that Tesla, as part of Master Plan Part 3, will build solar farms. And they're going to do it at scale. You've heard Elon talk about how it only needs 100 by 100 square miles to be able to, you know, to power all of the US or whatever. I can't remember the exact numbers that he gave. The second thing I've been saying is food. I'm predicting that Tesla and or Elon will create a new company that's going to address food. And the reason I feel that way is because I actually went to a secret party at the Giga Texas party, that the opening. And I was able to go into that party and actually, you know, take my shot and ask Elon Musk a question. The question I asked them was, using first principles, what is your approach to solving world hunger? At that time, it was a topic was pretty heavy in the society. And he answered by saying what he said before, which is there's no calorie deficit. The issue is more about getting the food to the right people at the right time, right? That's the issue. And then I went and talked to Kimball, his brother, and as we know, he's basically dedicated his entire life in restaurants and food. And so I asked him, are you and your brother going to address world hunger? And he gave me a very definitive yes. So we know that when you go to Mars, you're going to need to solve the food equation. Are you going to create a farm? Are you going to create, you know, all that? So my counter to what you were saying, which is that absolutely true, which is the transportation of the food is going to be drastically reduce price, be able to distribute it more. But I think where it's going to head towards is probably 3D printing of food, the ability to create the food wherever you are, anywhere you are, with minimal resources to be able to create whatever food you want. So when you were talking about that, that's where I think we were headed, is kind of like some sort of 3D printing. That totally conjecture on my part, but that's, I'll be curious to see. But I will guarantee you, Tesla and Elon will announce a net new business, a net new area of interest every year, every 2 years. There'll be something big. And the next big one, I think, is going to be food. What's your reaction to what I just said?
I think it's a distinct possibility. Now, whether or not it's within the fold of Tesla itself, or whether it's a right. sister company like SpaceX or the Boring Company mm-hmm. or something like that, but there would be logical consistency if we were to imagine that. Several reasons why. The first one, I think, is that Elon Musk's portfolio of companies reads like a strategy, Mars. A plan for yeah. colonization of Mars, yes. including the Boring Company for tunneling and so on. So food production is obviously going to be a big part of any planetary colonization undertaking. And so that wouldn't surprise me in the least. The other way that the food disruption and those technologies that I mentioned, the way that they interact with the energy, the transportation, and the labor disruption is through the infrastructure and how it's deployed. And so one of the things that's so extraordinary about solar, and to a less extent wind, but especially solar and batteries, is that they are viable at any scale. You can literally wear a solar and solar plus batteries power plant on your wrist. I was one of those nerdy kids who had a solar powered Casio watch.
Yeah, me too.
30 some odd years ago, right? So it solar and batteries works at every scale, from that up to the gigawatt scale and beyond. And so what that means is it's decentralizable. There's no barrier to entry for no minimum size, no minimum ante of tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to get in the energy game. You can do it at any scale, from an individual home on up. And that means it can be deployed anywhere. That's an extraordinary property. It has really quite profound social and equity implications, right? Because there are many places in the world that, there are many communities in the world, including in our own country, that for whom that barrier to entry, that initial ante to get in the game, is too much of an ask. It's too big of an obstacle to climb over. And these new technologies are going to just blow open the doors to deployment far more widely and far more equitably than could ever be achieved by coal power plants or even nuclear power plants, at least with existing nuclear technology. So that's exciting. Well, what's exciting is that the same thing is true with food, right? Breweries are all over the place, and they can be quite small. You can brew in your own home. And breweries are also decentralizable, distributed. They can be deployed at various scales viably anywhere. And if they're coupled on site with decentralized energy, well, then you have a food system and an energy system that aren't reliant on the rest of the grid, that aren't reliant on massive infrastructure, initial expenditures, and then upkeep requirements and so on. And so I think this is very exciting because, you know, you mentioned, how do you feed the world? How do you bring energy to the world? Well, it's certainly a heck of a lot easier to do it with these new technologies that are viable at different scales than it is with technologies that only work at an enormous scale. So that's something I think that's also worth being optimistic and finding very encouraging. Now, are there opportunities to thread those two things together on the enterprise and investment front? I'm sure there are. I'm certain there are. Somebody has to build all of those fermentation tanks and bioreactors. Somebody has to figure out how to set up systems that take solar power and energy from batteries and use them intelligently and efficiently in a food production system built based on these new technologies. And it may well be that 3D printing is part of that picture as well, part of that constellation of technologies that come together. And you can imagine, what would you need to get it to work on Mars? Well, we can imagine what that would look like. And then the interesting flip side of that is, the same system that would work on Mars would be absolutely fantastic in remote and low-income locations across the planet. So solve for problems on Mars, and you solve very much terrestrial problems as well. And I think this was one of the original beautiful things about NASA, is that that was part of the philosophy there as well. The breakthroughs and the progress made at NASA were things that were going to benefit humanity as a whole and lift all of us. And I think that that can absolutely be the case for for the technologies driving these four disruptions as well. And then the automation, humanoid robotics, they have a role to play there too. Absolutely have a role to play.
So I forgot to ask you this question. Could just go back to Tesla and electric vehicles for a second. I totally forgot this question, which is, what is your prediction of how fast will electric vehicles take over, diminish ICE vehicles? Some people believe that it's going to happen sooner than we think, that EV's growth rate right now is at 10% of all cars sold is an electric vehicle now. Countries are doing incentives, and that they're punishing the ICE vehicles to the point where you will see a complete precipitous drop of factories that are creating ICE vehicles. And it's just, we're already at ICE parity. Okay. Others are saying that it's going to take a long time. Some people think that, by 2030, yes, you'll have maybe 50%, but you're not going to be able to convince people. You can't switch them from the legacy concept. where do you guys stand? Or do you have a prediction of how this will play out?
We're definitely, the dynamics, certainly that we see in our modeling that are informed by the history of disruption, suggest that we're on a fast track, not the slow track that you described. So it's exponential. The growth is clearly exponential now. We're on that trajectory. And the inflection point is quite a long way out. We aren't at the point where we're going to inflect and start to see slowdown rather than year-on-year acceleration of EV adoption. That's a number of years away yet. So we're still growing exponentially. And as the new technology grows exponentially, then the old, in terms of market share, the old is the mirror reflection of that. The older technologies necessarily collapse on an inverse trajectory. That's just inevitable. One thing that is, I think, not widely recognized or discussed that we talk about extensively in our research and that Tony Seba has been talking about for over a decade is the critical role that automation and autonomous driving technology will have in accelerating this. And the reason why is once a car can drive itself, it doesn't just make that vehicle enormously valuable, which obviously it does, but it radically diminishes the value of any vehicle, any existing fleet of vehicles or any of those assets. All of anything that can't drive itself becomes much, much less valuable, much, much less desirable once you have the option to buy something that can drive itself. And this is in particular is operative for people choosing whether or not to own a vehicle at all. That's the important thing to understand here, right? So it's not just, I'm not going to drive my ICE vehicle myself manually for another 15 years until the end of its life. I'm just going to get rid of it and switch to a new vehicle that can drive itself. That forcing function, that set of incentives is much stronger for switching to a self-driving vehicle from a manual vehicle than the incentives are to switch from an ICE vehicle to an EV. Much, much stronger. But on top of that, you also have the enormously powerful incentives of not having to own a vehicle at all to switch from owning a vehicle to switch from to transportation as a service, to just moving around with the robotaxi fleet. And because it's so much cheaper and in many cases, much, much more convenient. So that is the shift that we're going to see. The precipitous collapse of the older technologies, not just the manufacture of new ICE vehicles, but continued use of older ICE vehicles that already exist, there's going to be more rapid abandonment of those old assets than is widely anticipated, because people don't fully, I think, appreciate the real value and the real opportunities and choices that people are going to make once a autonomous robotaxi fleet is available. And we've only just started to see the potential of that in a few narrowly geofenced areas where, you know, nearly level 4 service is available from autonomous vehicles. But, when Tesla rolls out its update and its fleet can properly drive themselves, we're going to see a major paradigm shift in the general public consciousness, in the zeitgeist around where the value really lies. And we're going to see a catastrophic plummet in value of the existing ICE fleet. And a corresponding explosion of the value of, well, frankly, of Tesla's fleet, but any vehicles that can drive themselves, and especially if those vehicles are electric. So that's what's coming. And again, this isn't 30 years from now. You know, this is within the next decade for sure.
You have probably the best job anybody could possibly have. Certainly for me, I want to do your job. You get to study new technology. You get to, research all these things that are coming. And like you said, it's no longer this research thing, which, be beautiful in 30 years. It's actually all happening in real time in front of your eyes. So in the meantime, I need to be reading, watching all your videos. You've got your channel on YouTube called Brighter. It's RethinkX is the website, and I need to go look through all of your studies that you've done just check you out somewhere, because this is exciting. This is happening now. And you guys have
disruption
is now. It's no longer this thing's coming. And you guys have a better understanding of the exponential curve. And we talked about so much about energy, even food, bots, autonomous driving. So it's touching everything, and I feel better about this potential utopian future. I'm still not quite ready, although I'm a very big optimist. I'm still not quite ready to just, you know, just offhand say, yep, it's going to happen. But you've given me a lot of thought here. So I really appreciate this, Adam. Thank you so much. You guys have to check him out on Twitter. He is at Adam_Dorr, D-O-R-R. And the YouTube channel's RethinkX. Got to understand that. And then, of course, you have to check out his book. And the way to remember his book is basically the same name as this channel, Brighter with Herbert. The book is called Brighter with Adam, Adam Dorr.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being with you. And there's so much more to talk about. I mean, you know, we're going to have to do this again.
Oh, yeah. And, oh, we will.
There are nuances, there are details that we barely scratched the surface of any of these topics, and of especially the humanoid bot. That's quite an exciting development.
Let's do that, because
the full conversation. Yeah.
One of the things that this was a general overview of disruptive technologies. What I'd like to do is get right into very specific technologies and actually see your graphs of timeframes and bear down on them with a critical eye. What are the issues that possibly could delay these things? But it sure seems like that they're all converging together really quickly. So I'd love to do that. Okay. Thank you so much, Adam. Great. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.
Thank you so much.